York City, 1927. A chauffeur opens the door to a gleaming Packard. Out steps a man in a charcoal gray three-piece suit, a fresh white carnation pinned to his lapel. I know you're riveted, Greg. Inside, the orchestra is playing. Crystal glasses clink together. Broadway actresses are laughing with newspaper publishers. Jazz spills from the stage. Everyone in the room turns toward the entrance, not because they're afraid, but because they're hoping he'll stop by their table. No bodyguards, no flashy jewelry, no cigar clenched between his teeth, just an impeccably dressed Englishman with movie star charm. If you didn't know any better, you'd think he owned half of Manhattan. The truth? He practically did. Then you think, his name wasn't Al Capone. It wasn't Lucky Luciano. Tonight, I'd like to introduce you to the gangster America forgot. I'm Rachel O'Brien, and this is Seven Deadly Sinners. In this setting, outside the streets of Harlem, are alive. Taxi horns echo through the warm summer air. Couples dressed to the nines hurry beneath glowing marquees. A line stretches around the block for America's hottest nightclub. Politicians are telling jokes they wouldn't dare repeat in public. Heavyweight boxers are buying drinks for the entire room. Everything feels glamorous. Now let me ask you something, Greg. If you walked into this room in 1928 and I asked you to point out the most dangerous man in the building, who would you choose? Think of some examples. Like a big, giant bodyguard-looking type. Like someone way too big for that era. Or a guy in a pinstripe suit, maybe a fedora.
You know, I think from that era, anybody wearing their zoot suit.
Okay.
You know, I might...
Or the guy with a scar across his cheek.
Definitely.
The rough and tumble
little
one.
Scar face.
A little broken, you know, nose?
I'd say I'd probably pick out an Italian.
Okay.
I'd try to at least. And
okay.
Yeah, the bigger, the meaner, the uglier, you know, is where I'd lean.
Okay. That's probably what I would have guessed too, but we'd both be wrong. Because the most dangerous man in that room doesn't look dangerous at all. He sits quietly in his perfect tuxedo. He smiles politely as entertainers come up to greet him and shake his hand. He never raises his voice. He doesn't need to, which is a very smart tactic. They say the quietest person in the room is the most influential.
Yeah,
or something.
Yeah. Speak softly and carry a big stick.
Yeah.
That's Teddy Roosevelt.
Okay, I like it. All right. He doesn't need to make a big show of himself. Because everyone in the room already knows exactly who he is. Not just the celebrities, not the politicians, not even just the famous musicians. No, because they're here because of him. And his name is Oney Madden.
Oney Madden.
I'm going to guess you've never heard of him.
Never heard of him.
Most people today never have.
Oney, like he owns it all.
I didn't think about that. That's crazy.
Once you own enough, you just become an Oney.
Well, and most people have never heard of him, but how is that even possible? I mean, how does a man help build a criminal empire worth millions of dollars, own some of the most famous nightclubs in America, rub shoulders with Broadway royalty, survive gang wars that killed dozens of rivals, then quietly retire, only to disappear from history?
I think that's honestly like the true mob boss's dream. Right?
Yeah.
Like, you know, you don't go out in a hail of gunfire. You don't ever get pinched. You know, like you slowly back away from the table.
Well, because he was smarter.
You know, I wonder what he did in his retirement. You know,
well, you're going to find out.
Okay, awesome.
And it's pretty dang interesting. So today we're going to fix that, or tonight we're fixing that, because I imagine most people, well, I listen to podcasts day and night. So
day and night.
Yeah.
All podcasts. Well, I mean, it is the daytime right now.
Yeah, when we're recording. But all right. So who is Oney Madden? He's from Yorkshire. And there's two kinds of gangsters. The first kind wants everyone to know how dangerous they are.
okay? The boy from Yorkshire kind of figured out early on that wasn't the best move. The second kind of hopes you never realize until it's far too late. So we'd go kind of stupid gangster, you know? But Oney, Madden belong firmly in the second category, sort of. America's future king of bootlegging wasn't American at all. He was born Owen Vincent Madden on December 18th, 1891 in Leeds, England, to Irish parents. Now, when we picture legendary gangsters, they often imagine larger-than-life personalities who seem destined for crime from the moment they could walk. But Oney, his story begins with something much more familiar. His parents wanted a better life, which I believe that a lot of the Italian immigrants that came over weren't. I don't know that he's special in that respect, but if you read, like, oh, sources for this episode are the Encyclopedia of Arkansas, spoiler alert for how he retires, Wikipedia.
Oney went to the Ozarks.
You'll find out.
Okay.
Okay. But I kind of believe that, like, even Al Capone, like, they came over here because their parents wanted a better life or something.
Yeah, it wasn't like organized crime brought them over.
Yeah, it wasn't
they
like
found
the,
it here.
Yeah.
But so, it's, you know, I like it. He's an Irishman from England.
Yeah,
know.
He is different than all the Italian gangsters because most of the...
It's giving me some Joey Pyle vibes.
Yes, it is. Which is
we're right in the gangster pocket.
That, which is why I chose this story.
Yes.
That's a total side story, but we can't wait for you to hear a podcast and watch a documentary.
It's coming down the pipeline. We can't say too much, but if you want to know more, there's going to be a Be Here for a While episode out this week, which we will touch a little more on.
Our trip to LA, where I interviewed a not gangster, and Greg recorded it and filmed it, and...
We're making a hit podcast.
Yeah. When I say not gangster, did he know John Gotti? Yes. That's all I'm saying.
Hey, is knowing somebody a crime?
Yeah. But he ended up being one of the sweetest, funniest men. Anyways, if you want to listen to it.
That's another story. That's another podcast. That's a whole nother season of a podcast.
Yep. Well, we're doing a whole podcast on him.
Exactly.
We spent 10 days and
it'll be coming
40
out
hours interviewing him.
Later this year, if you're lucky. Yeah.
Anyways. Back to the story. Yeah, so we were talking about, like, when people picture legendary gangsters, they're picturing larger-than-life personalities, but...
This is the pretty boy gangster. The handsome do-gooder.
I wouldn't say he was exactly handsome. Well, I'll show you a photo. Anyways, so his parents came across the Atlantic chasing opportunity, and they settled into one of the roughest neighborhoods imaginable, Hell's Kitchen. Now, what we can picture today, it is a gritty Manhattan neighborhood, but now it's far less gritty. It's got trendy restaurants and expensive apartments. Hell's Kitchen is one of the nicest areas in Manhattan now. But that's not the Hell's Kitchen we're talking about. At the beginning of the 20th century, Hell's Kitchen was one of the toughest neighborhoods in America. Violence was not unusual, it was ordinary. And children learned very early on that the streets weren't safe.
Hey, it's Ryan Seacrest here, and I have discovered a fun new escape from the daily grind, Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has hundreds of social casino-style games and it's all free to play anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. So get to ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21 plus.
So along with kids realizing that the streets of Hell's Kitchen weren't safe, they learned very early on which streets could possibly be safe and which ones to avoid, which corners belong to which gangs, and which grown men to avoid after dark. If your family was poor, and most families were, you learned to survive any way you could. For Oney, school wasn't nearly as valuable as the lessons waiting outside. By the time he was barely a teenager, he was already running with neighborhood gangs. And according to his own account, Madden committed his first crime at the age of 14, clubbing a man and stealing $500.
That's a pretty big come up at that time.
Yeah, I don't know why someone was carrying $500.
$500 in the 20s, dude? That's like 10 grand.
Yeah, probably.
Something around
there's,
there.
There's a comparison in this.
It also was interesting how, like, yeah, corners were owned.
Yeah.
You know? And the gang, the amount of gang action in that time, you know, it just like, I don't think it's anywhere close to what it is now, even though, you know, we have all these ways to communicate with, you know, the internet and phones and everything else. But like back then, it's all kind of like word of the mouth.
Yeah, you knew not to go. That corner belonged to Mickey. It belonged to Mickey. This corner belonged to.
I think that's another thing is
Luciano.
That, like, you know, communication had to be done in person.
Yeah.
Right? So, like, yeah.
Which was far more dangerous because then they knew if you went and you met. That's why they had to meet in warehouses and stuff.
Exactly. With the back of, you know, restaurants and the in the dark corner booth.
Yeah.
To have private conversations.
But you have to get into that restaurant some way.
Crazy. Crazy
which is
time.
Why there was tunnels. Anyways.
I also think that's why everyone was so much more well-dressed back then because it's like everything had to happen in person.
That's a good point.
Kind of wish we'd go back to that.
That'd be nice.
Even though I hate getting dressed up.
Oh, you look so handsome when you do.
I'd still be a ragamuffin.
Okay, whatever. So, back to the corners and whatever, and the gangs, I mean, they were everywhere. And in Hell's Kitchen, joining a gang often meant someone had your back. It was protection, identity. Identity was very important, I think, for a poor kid, you know, especially coming from, you know, England with Irish parents, like...
Yeah, where do you fit in?
Yeah, where do you fit in? I mean, again, most of the kids were poor.
The Irish might not like you because you might have a Cockney accent because you grew up in England.
Yeah.
You know, the English might not like you because you're actually Irish. The Italians don't, you know?
Yeah, and Italians and Irish feuded. But whatever. So it was protection, identity, a paycheck, sometimes all three. Now, here's what I love about these stories. The people who eventually become legends rarely look like legends at the beginning. So, again, imagine 14-year-old Oni. Yes, he did club a man and rob him at 14. But he was short. He was quick. Still carrying the traces of his Yorkshire accent. Probably impossible to pick out from dozens of other neighborhood kids. Nothing about him screamed future crime boss. But one trait stood out almost immediately. He was fearless. Almost unnervingly so. Some people freeze under pressure, others panic. Oni got quieter. Calmer. That ability to keep his emotions tucked neatly behind a polite smile would become one of his greatest weapons. Because while other gangsters exploded with anger, Oni observed, calculated, waited, and then acted.
You know who I'm almost thinking like, of?
Oh, I was thinking of a mountain lion, but who are you thinking of?
Kind of, well, that's a good reference, a mountain lion. I'm thinking of Rip.
Oh, yes.
You know,
Rip from Yellowstone and Dutton Ranch.
Dutton Ranch, just his silence is, and his stoic stern.
Is terrifying.
Yeah, yeah, you know.
But he's
it is,
sweet as pie, it's, to his wife
well,
at least.
Yeah, to his wife.
To his wife, that's
as
funny.
Every man should be.
Yeah.
You know, stoic and mean to the boys and sweet as pie to your wife.
But he does just like, it's. I mean, I know it's a fictional character, but there are people that are like that. They, I mean, I do believe like Oni had
in this
history.
Met a few ranchers just like that.
Yeah,
meant
exactly.
A few words, but
yeah, my dad's
yeah,
like
right, it's my, literally
my
saying
dad is
dad.
Exactly like that.
Yeah, you know,
my dad always says never let anyone know what you're thinking.
Exactly.
And my dad is the sweetest man in the world. He spoiled the hell out of me and my sister. Even
he
though
learned he, a lot from those trees.
Yeah,
stand stoic.
He's
silent.
Loves my mom so much. I mean, he's the perfect family man. But in business, he'll just stare at you.
That'll get a lot done.
Yeah.
When you got a strong stoic stare like your dad or Oni here.
And your hands are like softball mitts when boys would come over to pick me up for prom in high school. He'd shake their hand, but he would pretty much say nothing.
Yeah.
He would just... And that's a terrifying move.
Very much so.
So, yeah, that's funny. But also a mountain lion. But that's hard to... That's what I was thinking, though, is because...
Quietly watching you.
Oh, because they always say that a mountain lion, I mean, especially around here, we have like the highest concentration of them. They can be watching you and you have no idea that they're there. Zero idea.
I mean...
Until you do, but they rarely attack
humans.
One of
my favorite stories is our neighbor to the north lived here his whole life. He's in his 80s.
Told we got a train here.
That he's only seen five mountain lions in the noonday sun in his whole life.
That's still a lot in the noonday sun.
Yeah, I mean, like...
I've seen three bobcats.
For as many as we have here. We have the highest population in the state of Colorado, but we actually have the least amount of cattle attacks because there's so many mule deer here. They have such a rich source of food. You know, they don't typically attack livestock. However, there are hundreds of them just in our ridgeline right here. And it's like, yeah, they're such great stealth prey animals that, like, you know, you won't see them until it's too late.
Yeah. I would rarely, although mountain lions have, I mean, last year and other places and probably here, attacked humans. Like, they ripped a woman off a bike and stuff, like a grown woman. But usually they say those are juveniles whose, like, one of their parents had been killed or whatever.
Yeah, they're hungry, they're confused. They're up in Colorado Springs where there's not nearly as many mule deer or, you know, sources of food, you know, and the suburban, the sprawl is crawling into, really encroaching into their habitat. So, you know.
I think we're fine out here. I worry about, like, little pets. I used to worry about Blue a lot.
Yeah.
And if we get a new puppy. Anyways. Well,
I mean, and they are, like, every time we have a snow, I see mountain lion prints.
Oh, yeah.
Like,
I do too. I see their
30 feet from our house.
I see their tail drag behind their prints.
Yeah, but, like, we never see them. We've got them on our trail cams.
Yeah. Big one.
200-pound cat for sure.
Yeah.
Anyhow.
We're off track, but...
This is no longer a mountain lion podcast. Let's get back to gangsters. The gangsters of the mountains. But if you don't
live on 100 acres in the middle of nowhere, Colorado, that's a taste of it. All right. So that's what made him incredibly dangerous. Observed quietly, calculated, waited, and then acted. So, you grew up fast in that area. There were no guidance counselors, no safety nets. Instead, there were saloons, bookmakers, street gangs. Like, he was probably every man for himself. I imagine he probably had nice parents, but, like, they probably had to work day and night just to survive.
Yeah, they're doing blue-collared work.
And so he's on the street. So, ambitious young men looking for someone willing to prove themselves... Oney proved himself earlier than almost anyone. Before he was old enough to even vote or legally drink, he'd already become associated with violent street crime. And this is where his reputation really got solidified. Yes, he became more calculated later, but it's not because he was the biggest fighter. He wasn't. Not because he was the loudest. Because he developed an unsettling... And it was unsettling, they say, willingness to finish a fight. And in the underworld, people noticed that. They began calling him the killer. So, like, probably under 18, under 19, he was already being known as the killer. Imagine earning that nickname before your 20th birthday. The killer.
Yeah, that's saying something. I mean, it's one thing to just beat some guys up. It's another thing to end their life.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a very mountain lion
okay.
nickname. I think they could have gone with the mountain lion or the cougar, but, you know, we'll take it. The killer's pretty good, too.
Owen Madden had already become someone older gangsters took seriously. Again, he was a kid. Now, that doesn't mean he was invincible. Far from it. He was arrested. He spent time behind bars. But he learned firsthand how quickly fortunes could change. But prison didn't scare him away from crime. It educated him. Think of it as a dark business school.
That seems to be the case with...
With a lot of people.
Yeah, you know. We got a few friends who spent some time in the slammer, and all of them, I think, went in as more innocent men than they came out.
Yeah.
After, you know, that's where the crime really gets organized.
Yeah. Yeah, organized, yeah. That's really, you really develop your tough skin. That's where you
crime.
Learn the school of hard knocks.
Yeah. That...
Like, if someone told me to go sell a drug on the street or how to, like, do... I have not... No.
Well, you'd know to wear your big, poofy Pacers jacket.
Oh, yeah, that's true. That's the only two times in my life anyone's ever asked me for drugs, and it was very confusing. The first, I'll just, this quick side story. This may have to be a two-parter for all of our interjections, but this is, you know, it's a true crime comedy podcast of sorts. So I have this puffy, like, 1980s Pacers jacket, and we go to a bar in Trinidad here, the Dad Lounge, shout out to them, and this older man who was really drunk came up to me, and he goes, "You're Crystal, right?" And I was like, "No." And he's like, "No, you're Crystal." And I was like, "No, my name's Rachel." He's like, "No, you're Crystal." I was like, "Again, no."
Then he got visibly frustrated and walked away.
Yeah. And then Greg was like, "I think he was asking you for crystal meth."
And I was like, "He was definitely asking you for crystal meth."
And then he got taken out because he was so drunk. I guess he wanted the crystal meth to sober himself up. I don't know. And then the other time, Greg and I are in Sedona, Arizona, driving from Colorado to LA for some project. And we stayed the night. And I think Greg was playing a show. It was when you were playing a show there.
Yeah.
We stopped. Yeah. And so I had made friends with this. When I say like most like perfect, innocent looking, not really wearing much makeup, in yoga pants, like you would think that that girl didn't even ever go out. Like, whatever. And then her boyfriend. And I'm sitting with them while Greg's like tuning up his guitar or whatever, talking to him. And she just leans across the table and she goes, "Hey, do you got any cocaine?" I was like, "No." "Huh?" She's like, "Do you have cocaine?" I was like, "No, thank you. No." And I said to Greg, I was like, "What about me is..."
It's the Pacers jacket.
And then
jacket.
We realized it was the jacket. It looks like a drug dealer's jacket.
It's like a starter, you know, Logo 7 starter brand jacket from the 90s. Definitely the meanest girls in my high school wore jackets just like that, you know, with, you know, different NBA teams on them. But I can remember, like, all of the, you know, at the time we called them ghetto girls that weren't, you know, they didn't come from the ghetto. They lived with nice parents in a suburban home, but they would just, you know, listen to rap.
Oh, like my sister.
Yeah. So anyhow.
But yeah, so.
If you want to be a drug dealer, get yourself a
starter jacket.
Starter jacket.
The puffier, the better.
From the late 90s NBA team. Doesn't matter which NBA team. You will be asked for drugs.
There we go. So he got educated in prison. Inside prison, he met future mob bosses, met future bootleggers, corrupt politicians, professional thieves. Connections were made and lessons were exchanged. When Oney walked back onto the streets of New York, he wasn't just tougher. He was smarter. He understood something many lifelong criminals never figure out. Street fights might earn respect, but businesses earned fortunes. And history was about to hand him the greatest business opportunity organized crime has ever seen. What do you think it is?
Newspapers.
Prohibition.
Oh.
God,
hey.
I lobbed that up like a softball to you.
Newsboys. Extra, extra.
Okay, that's how nerdy you are. you go, newspapers.
Newspapers.
I think it's newspapers, not illegal alcohol smuggling.
Yeah, see? Okay. I don't do that stuff. I just drink my coffee and read the news.
Dork. But before America outlawed alcohol, Oney Madden had one more lesson to learn. One that would completely change the way organized crime operated. Because he discovered that power isn't always built with violence. Sometimes it's built with velvet curtains, crystal chandeliers, and perfect tailoring. And making everyone in the room forget they're sitting next to one of the most dangerous men alive.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Victory Lane? Yeah, it's even better with Chumba by my side. Race to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Which leads us to our cold open. That's how he presented himself. But before, you know, having the money to really dress like that, he did have to rise to the area's most violent gang, the lead of that most violent gang, the Gophers. In 1911, he also married and briefly lived with Dorothy Rogers, whom he had his only child, Margaret. A professional killer and gunman, he was wounded many times. In 1915, he was sentenced to Sing Sing Prison for manslaughter. That's a bad one.
That's a bad one. That's where, well, we can't talk about it.
Yeah, yeah. It's our project.
We don't know anybody who went to jail.
Yeah, and maybe we shouldn't mention anything considering you were like, newspapers. And I was like, I don't know why you asked for drugs. I got to call my mom. Anyways, so he was sent to Sing Sing for manslaughter, but he was paroled in 1923. By then, the 18th Amendment, which marked the beginning of the Prohibition era, had made the manufacture, transportation, and sale of intoxicating liquor illegal. During Prohibition, numerous underground bars and saloons appeared, and the market for bootleg alcohol boomed. Now in his element, Madden made fast profits in bootlegging, nightclubs, and show business. Among other enterprises, he turned a failing Harlem night spot at Lenox Avenue and 142nd Street into the Cotton Club. Pretty famous club. I even knew that name.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And fabled showcase for black musical talent performing for white patrons in the jazz age. Madden also bankrolled the Hollywood careers of George Raft and Mae West, both of whom had lived in Hell's Kitchen. He was Mae West's boyfriend and protector. Sweet, but oh so vicious, she said. She would describe him that like that for years to come. Later years, early on.
Kind of reminds me of Rip.
Yeah. Sweet, but oh, there you go.
Sweet, but oh so vicious. That sounds like a song title, like a chorus to a good crooner, Frank Sinatra type song.
I like it. By the late 1920s, Madden was a millionaire, chief of an under... A million back in the day, there was... So one of his...
Here, I'll pull it up.
So this is just an example. So Madden, like, for example, in one of his shipments, he earned $50,000 from a shipment of liquor. But that wasn't just 50 grand. In today's money, you're looking at well over $750,000 from one shipment.
Yeah, so $1 million in 1920 is roughly equivalent to $16 million today.
Yeah, that tracks.
Goodness, why couldn't my great-grandpa just left me a cool million?
I think
that's
how the Kennedys made their money.
Yep, but then you know what they say, once you're rich enough, you stay rich.
Yep.
I don't know if they say that, but...
I let you have it.
It sounded a lot cooler in my brain, and then it came out, and it was like, I sound stupid.
Newspapers.
Newspapers. What did my family make its fortune on? Newspapers.
Oh, anyways. So, like I said, by the late 1920s, Madden was a millionaire, chief of an underworld empire that included real estate, boxing, gambling, bootlegging, breweries, and entertainment. With Frank Costello, Charles Lucky Luciano, and other mob figures, he organized a crime commission, or syndicate, if you will, whose objective was high profits, a business-like operating style, and a minimum of bad publicity. They were going to dress smart, act smart.
You know, wise guys.
Wise guys, there you go. By 1930, New York Governor Franklin D. Roosevelt was seeking a presidential nomination, a crackdown on the blatant corruption.
I didn't know that FDR was the governor of New York before president. Hey, you learn something new every day.
There we go. A crackdown on the blatant corruption of New York City was essential to his plan. On July 7, 1932, Madden was sent back to Sing Sing for parole violations. In 1933, he was released and Prohibition was repealed late that year. He was like, bummer. I missed out on a whole year of that. In his 40s and in chronic ill health because of his old bullet wounds, Madden was persona non grata in the New York underworld. Looking for a new life, here's where you're going to learn about his retirement. He began visiting Hot Springs, Arkansas, which had for years been a haven for gambling, prostitution, and bootlegging. The city was also a peaceful little spa, known for its beauty and its health-giving hot waters. And maybe visiting there made him contemplate settling life in exile, but still an active mobster. Like, he could still run around and hobnob and root and toot.
Root and toot.
But he could do it in the Ozarks, essentially.
I love it.
Is all of Arkansas in the Ozarks?
No.
Okay.
But I think, no, because some of the Ozarks, I think, go up into Missouri, too. Whatever. Anyhow, a good portion, like the, you know, the main portions are definitely all in Arkansas.
Okay. So while visiting there, Madden began romancing a hot springs gift shop clerk, Agnes Demby, the daughter of the local postmaster. On November 26, 1935, when she was 34 and he was in his mid-40s, they married and moved into a modest house on West Grand Avenue. So, contrary to myth, Agnes was not a small-town ingenue, but was well acquainted with her husband's racketeering friends, his prison record, and his way of life. Under what terms Madden left New York will never be known. High-placed New York politicians and criminals may have struck the deal, possibly with Frank Costello as broker or Lucky Luciano, who may have commissioned Madden to oversee mob operations in Hot Springs. But confined to Arkansas, he played a public role as a small-town gentleman. But it is reasonable to think that he played an active part in illegal activities in the spa. Hot Springs Mayor McLaughlin and Municipal Judge Vern Ledgerwood ran their own syndicate to manage gambling and prostitution, and while they stoutly denied that Madden had any hand in things or took any rake-offs, it was common knowledge that Madden furnished the wire service that brought racing results to bookmakers.
That's cool.
Yes. It seems unlikely that he and his mob associates provided this valuable service for free, but Madden was able to stay underground until 1940, but eventually came to own a controlling interest in the Southern Club, a lucrative gambling establishment on Central Avenue, as well as other gambling operations. A friend who's who of ganglord chiefs, Costello, Luciano, Mayor Lansky, and Joe Adonis, visited Madden regularly and openly in Arkansas. In 1946, the McLaughlin machine was voted out, but local rackets, after a few setbacks, continued to flourish, and Madden grew more visible and more powerful. He was still under constant FBI surveillance, but he continued as godfather to local charities and became a familiar figure in his trademark cap and scarf. In 1961, after a federal investigation concluded that Hot Springs was the site of the largest illegal gambling operation in the U.S., Madden was summoned before the Senate Committee on Organized Crime under Arkansas Senator John McClellan, the Rackets Committee, where he repeatedly invoked the Fifth Amendment. In 1964, the state took its first decision, steps to shut down illegal operations in the Hot Springs. And a year later, on April 24th, in 1965, Madden died of emphysema and was buried in Greenwood Cemetery. And that's the story.
Epic. One
of Oney Madden.
Let's open up a saloon and casino.
Yeah.
Maybe we need a local book. We can be the bookmakers.
Well, it's in some of these like articles that make his like move to Arkansas like more, what is that word? Picturesque or whatever. It said that he just retired from, you know, the mob world in New York and like lived on a horse ranch as a peaceful horseman.
Yeah.
That's a good cover up, especially if you're running the books for horse racing.
Maybe that's what we're doing out here.
Yeah. maybe that's what we're doing. Just because you own a horse, that makes you a criminal?
What? No, I love it though. Like, one, it's given me big time Chicago mob vibes from the same era where, as we found out with our recent research, that like, MCA, the record company, mm-hmm. You know, had mob dealings.
Most of the record industry seemed to have.
In Chicago, and they would get, you know, the best Jelly Roll Morton and, you know, all these black artists to perform in their clubs, and they had their tentacles, you know, in everything. And it's cool just to kind of, you know, hear about these gangster stories. And then even more so, really cool that, like, okay, so this guy, Oney Madden, is like pre-Lucky Luciano.
No, because he
like
formed a syndicate
same
with him.
Time, you yeah. know, same time frame, different side of the,
yeah.
you know, street, but, you
do,
know.
Do you know what it actually just reminded me of, and we'll wrap this up in a second. In the area we live in, and I know everyone has an Al Capone story, but it is absolutely true in the area we live in. Al Capone
married.
He came here to hide out, continue his prohibition over the Santa Fe Trail and in our tiny little town, but our tiny little town was overrun back in the day. Now it's a grocery store.
They used to call it Little Chicago.
Yeah. It was like a 5,000 to 10,000 person town. Now it's 500 people. But it had saloons and brothels and everything on every corner. But it was so out in the middle of nowhere that it was easier for Al Capone to hide. I mean, he would go to his local bar and sit in his black chair, and then his buddies would sit, and that's just right. I mean, it's now the History Museum, and I volunteer there. But yeah, his buddies would distract the, because they eventually found out he was here, but they would usually get shot in the streets before they would get Al Capone, because his buddies would distract them, whatever, and then Al Capone would drop down in a tunnel, go across to where Ringo's, the grocery store I worked at for a hot second, was, and then go into kind of the dried up riverbed, the Apishapa River, and just crawl his way, you know, then through tunnels that go under our property.
Yep. Yeah, so he paid out-of-work miners to dig a tunnel from Aguilar to Walsenburg large enough to fit a Model T through. And we've got a Model T here on the property. It could be Al Capone's. We don't know.
Not our business to investigate. Hey, I'm joking.
I will say, though, there is a lot of really cool, old-school Black Hand Syndicate, mafia stories related to our little town, and Rachel has been researching all of them. And if you want to hear about all of them, Rachel's actually doing guided
tours.
You can book them on Airbnb.
Yeah.
Right? So if you want your kind of own in-person Rachel O'Brien-led historical Black Hand Syndicate podcast tour.
And you want a little vacation?
You could come out to the ranch. You could even book an Airbnb. We're officially on Airbnb now. Our studio container is
a container home, but it's nice. It's very nice. It's
750 square feet.
Yeah.
The first one we built out here. It's very nice.
We'll put a link to it in the show notes.
Yeah, a little link to it in the show notes. We've got nothing but 5-star reviews. I think we had 1 4-star review.
Yeah. My experience of the tour guide is not. It will be up in 2 days on there. It's been approved, but it takes 2 days.
Ah, yes.
Yes. So I haven't done it yet, but I'm starting it. You know, but I am a volunteer at the History Museum, so.
She's learned from all of the locals who lived here her whole life. We've gone out on expeditions with, I don't even know how old.
Charlie's got to be 80, so I don't know. Well, late 70s, maybe.
No, dude, he's in his 80s.
Oh, okay.
Gotta be.
He looks great.
Because, I mean, his dad was here, like, in the bootlegging days. Well, we cannot get into it.
Yeah,
but
anyways.
You take the tour, she'll tell you the tales. She's been trained up and educated by all the locals, and it would be really awesome anyhow.
Well, thank you guys so much for listening. I hope you do book a tour. I'd love to meet you in person. And till next time.
Great story.
Thank you for listening. Love you. Bye.
Hey, it's Bubba Wallace from 2311 Racing. You know what it feels like forever? Sitting on a plane waiting for takeoff. Good thing I've got Chumba Casino. With daily boosts and social casino games on tap, this is the kind of fun that makes time fly. Why not turbocharge your downtime? Play now at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21+. Terms and conditions apply.